Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is November 23rd, 2023, and in the United States, that means it is Thanksgiving, which means John's not here today. He is out for the next 2 weeks. I believe he's taking some vacation time, so we'll catch up with him sometime in December. But I'm joined today by Mr. Greg Lee.
You wouldn't spend it any other way, would you, James?
I mean, I already did all my familial obligations. I'm in cool down time now. And Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
I'm also in cool down time and have been for the past month.
Yeah. Cold?
Yes, definitely.
Oh, okay. This is the witty repartee that we come for. I'm glad
so
I've got.
Sorry. I'm glad I caught you by surprise.
Got such great improv partners here. Mm-hmm. This is episode 850, which we'll call it a momentous occasion for no particular reason. And
well, they used to be, didn't they? It used to be. You know, but before the podcast was, 17 years old. 50 episodes roughly being a year's worth of episodes, it kind of meant something.
Right. So we are closer to episode 1,000 than we are to episode 500. So that's worrying.
See, that maybe would have been the place where I would have taken the whole cooldown thing. Maybe you should have asked, only for the past month. As in, haven't you been coasting for the last few years?
And I
would have to say, yes, I have been.
This is the kind of improv show where we come back to previous segments where the first one just fell flat. We're just like, hey, audience,
let me just get the telestrator out and show you what was meant to happen on that play.
Actors quickly trying to put their costume from the previous act back on.
I could always edit this show to make it sound all witty and shit, but that's too much work. Too much work.
And
people
skill.
Won't believe it. The artifice would be too high. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do a little bit of a shortened show. We're going to do some email this week. We're going to do a bunch of it, actually. Our goal is to get through a lot of email in a expeditious fashion, which is always just never going to work.
It's not even really worth trying when John's here, is it? Because it's just going to come up the works.
The anecdotes and the
impressions and all this stuff,
I mean, that's why they call him John Long-Winded Lindemann.
I thought that the lawn in Lon Jinderman was short for Lon Winded.
That's Lon Winderman. Oh God, that's now Lon Jinderman's back in my brain. I had evicted that character, and now he's back.
Well, I mean, we got an email not that long ago.
It's been a bit.
Yeah, we haven't used it, but...
No, but it was a retroactive suggestion from Mr. Jinderman.
Oh, so the reality of the situation is I went through those retroactive suggestions in such a mechanical way that I didn't even notice Lon Jinderman was responsible
I don't think you prejudiced the request to consider Metal Black the Taito shooter by saying, well, this is a Jinderman request, so immediately it's on thin ice or anything like that. You just treated it as a straight-up earnest suggestion.
I try so hard to do these things correctly, and then I miss the opportunity to note that Lon Jinderman has made his untriumphant return.
I mean, there's a whole, P.S., why don't you guys ever use any Wu-Tang for the outro music? It's always Yoko whoever or Motoi, what's his name, with the rock organ and the gazillion guitars. Give a little respect to the old school. I recommend Duel of the Iron Mike from GZA's seminal hip-hop masterpiece, Liquid Swords. It's a killer track. Thank you. So yeah, clearly that's non-genuine.
I wish John listened to the show right now, in this particular moment.
For my delivery?
Email is flagged with the rest of the song requests as the same process. Again, neither fear nor favor.
I guess I'll lead with this email. So I put a couple people on blast for the garbage that they sent us. Stuff that just did not follow the instructions at all. One person in particular got called out, and I feel like I should have given some more heat to other people, including Will, who wrote, quote, "Fuck your broke ass reason, a prime retroactive candidate, play motherfucking Metroid motherfucking Prime. And my answer to that was to remove it from the list. And to myself, tell Mr. World to fuck off.
Now, so, that was a fair bit more hostile than the one that you actually decided to put on blast.
It is. Like, so I'm going to go ahead and read this email because I'm doing it. I've already broken the order of the email that I've sent through, and that's fine. This is from John, not our John. This is John with an H, who writes, "Hey guys, I'm sorry for not following the rules and suggesting Epic Mickey. I realized my mistake when I listened to the next show and assumed it would just be ignored. I was surprised to have my incorrect suggestion featured. My only excuse is that my son was born 3 days before I sent the email, and I probably wasn't paying much attention to the show as I usually do. Anyway, RFN is the best, and hopefully I will get in better suggestions next time. Thanks for all that you do. Your show is wonderful at 3 a.m. with the crying baby." I appreciate that you're owning your mistakes. That's a step towards self-improvement. I don't like blaming children for your own failures, though. That's just really not fair to them. It's not their fault. They're children. Come on, please.
So, James, you reamed into a sleep-deprived listener, and you just you're just gonna okay, yeah. I guess all the apologies need to come from him and not you. Okay.
The apologies flow in one direction. Yes, this is how this works.
All right.
I have long said that I'm beyond reproach, and I stand by that statement. Now, to be fair, his mistake was really just like, oh my God. Okay. Well, I think this one stuck out because it was the first email I ran into where it was just like, person just blindly just disregarding the very limited parameters we set out. It was not the last, but it just stuck out because it was the first. But yeah, the one where we were told by Will to quote, fuck our cheap ass retroactive and play Metroid motherfucking Prime, despite the fact that half the show had already played it in the last 6 months.
Yeah, it has been discussed recently. So, it's like, yeah.
Why?
Not the most natural candidate on that basis. And of course, it turns out it's on sale, isn't it, at the moment, for people who hadn't already bought it. So, you know.
It is on sale. You know what else is on sale?
It was on sale when it came out just like last month or something. Like, it's not that old a release. And then for like 1 or 2 weeks, it was not on sale. That's when
That's Seventh Guest you're about. Metroid Prime is on sale.
Oh, nice.
So
yeah. Okay.
Actually, that is a cheap-ass option now.
It is now. But it wasn't at selection time. But Guillaume just stole my thunder. Another game on sale right now is the Seventh Guest. Why is that important? Because the Seventh Guest is our next retroactive. We're going to be doing it probably in 2-ish weeks, but we won't be releasing the episode then because we're going to try to record that and maybe one additional episode so that we can take the holidays off too. But you still get us in your ears. You can't escape us. So, but that doesn't mean I want you to get your questions and comment, your questions, thoughts, comments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there is now a talkback thread in the Nintendo World Report forums in the podcast section. It's stickied at the top. It's called Retroactive Number 53, Seventh Guest. I think it's 53. And then Meowth created a subsection in the NWR Discord for the retroactive for Seventh Guest. So you can also post comments there. And of course, you can always email them to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Like these fine people did. And now, you know what? I'm going to lump in John with an H among these fine people because I appreciate that he reached out and said, hey, my bad. That's great. We get lots of bad emails. I'm not saying your email was bad, but we do get lots of bad emails and we never get apologies for them. We got an email this week that just had a bunch of dogs in it. No explanation given. This caused me to have like a minor aneurysm. So, you know who you are. What the fuck are you doing? We're going to go through some of the other emails we've received. Like I said, our emphasis is on expediency. And technically speaking, I've already done an email. So, I'm going to say we've been on target. So, Guillaume, would you read what is actually the first email in the rundown?
Sure. Lemonade writes, hi, guys. Here's a quick question for you. Will the next Mario Kart be called Mario Kart 9 or Mario Kart 10? I would say 9. I don't subscribe. I don't have James's weird hang up about how like they number these games, and Mario Kart Arcade is definitely like a a side thing. It's Mario Kart Gaiden. Like, it's not part of the main series.
No, so. Mario Kart Gaiden is the one with the RC cars.
Well, that's another spinoff. Like, it doesn't really affect anything.
You get one. You get one.
Anyway, it doesn't really work that way. But I don't see why, like, Mario Kart Deluxe is, you know, there's a lot of new content at this point over the original Mario Kart 8 release, but not enough to call it 9. Like, it's still the same gimmicks.
Well, I think the real thing that would possibly have a claim to be Mario Kart 9 that ties into that booster course pass stuff is Mario Kart Tour.
Sure does.
That's the one that's like, well, you know, especially the way that it did feed back into quote unquote mainline Mario Kart, if you want to look at it that way.
But to me, it's more like a significant game. We made these tracks for this, you know, this cell phone game that I'm sure is making a lot of money. I'm sure they're not, you know, it counts. Like, I'm not saying it doesn't count, but at the same time.
Well, if it counts, it's 9. That's counting.
No, but you know, like, then they're like, well, we put this work into making these tracks. Let's put them in a real Mario Kart game.
No,
get some sort of extra capitalization from the work that was put into them, with, you know, further work being required, of course. But still, it's I would say Mario Kart Tour has got a better claim to, you know, being somewhere in the, you know, worthy of a numeral sequence than the GP games, especially given, you know, because Mario Kart Tour is mostly internally developed, yes. So, you know, rather than, you know, being the product of Namco or something like that. Okay, of course, you know, there's always your support studios and contractors and things involved in. Although, I mean, Retro were quite involved in Mario Kart 7, weren't they? Because basically it was all hands to the pump, wasn't it? You know, I mean, the 3DS is everything's on fire, so you just we've got to get the big hitters out now with every development resource we can muster. Right. So obviously nothing's that neat and tidy, but still, yeah. Do I imagine that they would end up calling it Mario Kart 10 because we're just meant to assume that Mario Kart Tour was in fact 9 all along? I doubt it, but it's not like completely divorced from reality, if that were true.
So here's my counter to everything being said here. Mario Kart GP and GP2, Triforce board games, means they're basically running on a GameCube. Therefore, they're GameCube games. Therefore, they count. Bang, bang. Mario Kart board game. Nintendo originated with making things like toys, including board games, should count. Bang. Mario Kart Home Tour runs on Switch, counts. Mario Kart Phone definitely counts. They put all kinds of team, and the Mario Kart team made it. This would then be like Mario Kart 13, 14, but that's not what they're going to do because it's Nintendo. They're going to do something stupid. And starting at 7, with you counting, is stupid.
It's never had numbers. And then all of a sudden, well, 64, but that it wasn't because of
that,
the numbers.
Just everything is 64.
It's just a suffix for the system. But yeah, and then all of a sudden it has numbers because they think 7 is lucky or cool or whatever.
They just can't be fucking bothered.
And then it's like, well, 8
name.
Is kind of like, you know, a figure 8 track design. So that also works. That's the problem, isn't it? I mean, it's 9 or 10 or anything like after this. Does it appeal to their sense of, you know, which numerals are compatible with racing or just being
cool. I have
an
answer to that.
Go on.
That's where I'm going at. The next Mario Kart game is going to be called The Mario Kart.
I think, Matt, I see where you're going there, because, you know, the Fast and the Furious becomes Fast and Furious, or Final Destination becomes The Final Destination. Makes sense, but I would politely advance the notion of Mario the Kart.
Mario, but that implies Mario is a kart,
Maybe that's going to be the new gimmick, they're actually like Transformers and they turn into the karts themselves.
What if it's
every character gets a kart that's shaped like themselves, just like regular, you know, like
that's where it starts.
So they're like, sitting in the
already
cart
have,
like
the weird Yoshi motorcycle that obviously Yoshi amongst everyone else can ride.
So basically, people saw that. I mean, by people, I mean the characters in the Mario Kart universe, and they're like, "That's a freaking good idea." And
I also want to drive a nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. So peach just on top of a quad bike that's, you know, shaped like a rose gold peach. I don't know.
What if it's just heads with wheels at the bottom? So they're just sitting on top of their heads like the peach is sitting.
They're all
the
kind of like the Koopa clown car, but just like the character head versions of that concept.
They're the Mario face ship of carts, yes.
It's the face ship, of course.
There is canon to support this approach. But I actually think it's better if they transform into them. Because just being shaped like Mario doesn't make the cart itself Mario. To say it is Mario the cart, it must be Mario hath become the cart.
No. I mean, like, it's like, I don't know, Jaws the Ride or whatever it is. Like, it's not...
Jaws the Revenge.
But I mean more like a universal...
But that's referring to Jaws in the context of the movie. The series isn't called Mario.
Yeah, but sure. Like, there's a character named Mario in Mario Kart, and he's got a cart, and it's the Mario Kart.
But the shark from Jaws isn't named Jaws; it's just the shark.
Sure.
They get pretty personal by Jaws the Revenge. He probably did have a name,
right?
It's Frank.
Also, give the shark a cart is what I'm saying. Also, why not?
I mean, isn't the chain shop basically going?
Your idea of just putting wheels on carts that are shaped like heads of Mario characters, I would see that, but for some reason, my mind is picturing it in the style of Junji Ito stories.
I was thinking more like Shriner's cars, but okay, sure, we can go psychological horror.
Yeah,
but so I think the idea of at the start of every race, kind of like I think it's IndyCart where they have to run to their cars. You have to run to a collection of wonder seeds, grab one, transform into the car, and then go. That's the gimmick. That's the new gameplay. That's the Star Fox assault on foot section of the new Mario Kart world.
How about it's Mario Kart 9, but it's also a crossover with Peanuts characters because of the shape of their eyes. So that's what the 9 refers to, you know, like it's not a weird Mobius strip of an 8 or anything like that. It's I know it would be grasping a lot, but I don't know. We've seen worse.
We've had the Mercedes crossovers with Mario Kart, so...
Right.
What if every car is a sponsored car? And so then it's just Mario Kart $. It's all about the gold. Hmm. But when they say that, then you see the producer of Mario Kart and they're literally just wearing a gold suit. Satin, of course. Maybe they've got like grills in. Every car in here is sponsored.
And again, like maybe Mario Kart 8 Deluxe was the last Mario Kart game.
Yeah,
well, see, I think that would then give merit to them doing like a 4K upport of Mario Kart 8 Deluxe with all the extra DLC. We would call it the double deluxe concept.
Yeah.
What if? Hmm. But just calling it the Mario Kart at that point, because it would say this is the definitive article. This is the final collection of Mario Kart. There shall be no kart advance beyond this point. This is the literal alpha and omega of Mario Kart, in that the origins of Mario Kart is here, as is the end.
It may be a function of what they do with the system branding. How do they differentiate the next system? You know, do you keep Switch as part of it? Or if you have a modifier on Switch, what modifier is that? And then is that a modifier that could be applied to the Mario Kart name the same way that, you know, 64 was to Mario Kart 64? They might go that route if it kind of works. But then again, we have no idea what they're going to call the system. So, you know, because that is the natural... It wasn't exclusive. We had things like Double Dash, for instance, but we also had Mario Kart Wii, Mario Kart DS, Mario Kart 64. Obviously, Mario Kart was a little bit in between because it's like, well, yes, it was on the Super Nintendo, but you could also have just read it as that it was like
Super Mario Brothers
and all that kind of stuff. But and then it was almost like retrospectively we could look at it as being Super Mario Kart because it was on the Super Nintendo. Once they did all the other ones and put the console names as modifiers from that point on. So yeah, that's the first domino. What's the system going to be called? And then if that is compatible, that may well go that way. And the age of the numeral may be past us. But I guess the only thing you can say is just that it's been so bloody successful as they, you know, they dare turn away from you know, kind of the most obvious linear advancement of just calling it 9.
I think numbers are for cowards.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And I just don't mean in the context of numbering things. I just think the idea and concept of numbers are for cowards.
Right.
And so
the concept of quantifying things is for characters.
Have you seen the movie The Accountant with Ben Affleck? I think that kind of proves you wrong right there.
The second part of your sentence answered the first part. All right. Well, I think this is an interesting transition point.
Yeah.
Because we have.
By the way, I recommend everyone to see this masterpiece of a film. I don't know what he's playing.
This is the part where Guillaume's yes. tone sometimes makes it unclear if he's being sarcastic or not, and I have to sit there and think about it. But Ben Affleck in The Accountant is enough of like the world is a sarcastic place for me as is, so I think we're good.
Okay.
So actually, I'm gonna jump the email order again because I think Greg, you just gave us an interesting transition point.
Sure.
Also, you just said that numbers are for cowards.
Yeah, exactly.
And so is like an order.
Sequencing
is not necessarily a number.
Okay. Okay.
It could imply a number, but it doesn't necessarily require a number.
But you don't subscribe to that either.
I subscribe to sequencing. I don't subscribe to quantifying. Those are different concepts.
Yeah, it's true.
Okay, so why are you flying in the face of sequencing right now? Like, what's
Well, because as I was trying to explain,
he sensed the segue, and you pissed over it.
Okay,
Greg gave us a beautiful transition about what the Switch's successor is, and we have an email that speaks to part of that right away.
Okay.
Would it be Greg? Would it be your turn to read an email?
Sure. Yeah. So this is Patrick. Yes.
It is.
Patrick from Indiana writes, good time of day, gentlemen. Whole-time listener, once or twice emailer. As always, enjoy the podcast, though sometimes you guys overthink things. For example, video game quote-unquote modernity obviously began with the Atari 2600's adventure. Once the technology for rendering Dragon Ducks was mastered, the rest was gilding the lily. Long live the square. My question has to do with the Switch 2.0. At least I assume they aren't calling it the Nintendo Knob. The Joy-Cons were the central innovation, in my humble opinion, of the Switch, giving a bog-standard pad ergonomic viability. But we all know they've had durability issues, so assuming Switch 2.0 is roughly the same form factor as Switch 1, which way does Nintendo go from here? Do they keep the OG Joy-Con that won't please critics of Drift and it gives up a certain amount of revenue from selling new controllers? Do they replace it with something roughly similar but not backwards compatible, thus pissing off the financially challenged among us and confusing all grandparents everywhere for the rest of time? Do they attempt some radical redesign? It seems like moving too far away from the Switch form factor, unless there's a damn good reason, risks a Wii U-style flameout. The question, which will hopefully never again be referred to as the Joy Conundrum, haunts me. Please have at it.
I just want to say anecdotally, like, probably all of us have, you know... Well, I know that, Greg, you have alternatives, right, to Joy-Con.
Like, you seek the hoary pads,
and so did you, James. And, of course, like, personally, I mostly play the Switch on my TV, so I mostly use the GamePad Pro. So does Karen. It took me a while to come to the conclusion that buying two of those, despite their high price, was the way to go. But eventually I was like, yeah, I can't stand the Joy-Con. But just recently, one of my friends who... you know, like he got Mario Wonder. He was playing with his two daughters, and he was asking me, like, so what do you think about this GamePad Pro? Should I get one? And I was kind of, you know, he's got like a PlayStation, so he hasn't been personally playing the Switch all that much. But I was still kind of surprised, like, oh, like, what have you been doing all this time? Like, playing with a sideways Joy-Con? And apparently, yes, that's what's been happening for, like, the wow. past several years. So those people are out there. I'm sure he's not the only one out there. So I kind of have to believe that Nintendo doesn't really see a problem with a Joy-Con.
I think they do, but I think it's not necessarily a problem insofar as people don't like it as much as it is this thing costs us money with service calls.
Yes and no, only in North America, isn't it?
No, you can get them repaired in places like Japan.
Okay.
But also North America is their biggest market, so it is an issue.
But like didn't they actually beat or avoid the kind of class action thing or?
Yeah, I mean they avoided a class action lawsuit, but that was never going to get anywhere because fundamentally there is an understanding that devices have a breakdown. And so to achieve class action on that, it would have to prove that their degradation is to such a degree that it would be like selling a defective product. And given the fact that other controllers in the marketplace also suffer similar degradation, I think you would struggle to be able to make that claim effectively. And then you'd have to figure out what the actual damages is. And I think you'd end up with something that's relatively small because you could say, all right, you got a year and a half out of this controller. And then it started to have to experience damage.
I mean, you activate a side B move in an online game of Smash Brothers.
Right.
When you didn't want to.
What's the financial damage?
I mean, how do we quantify that? I mean, I don't care how cowardly you think that concept is. It's frightening to contemplate.
Mm. Yeah, like how do you quantify the damage? Like, well, are you in a, you know, at Evo? You just lose millions of dollars?
Your single Joy-Con to Evo.
That's right. Just my right Joy-Con, too. The one that's worse to play.
Yep.
I think the Joy-Con form... I mean, so the question sort of implicitly requires us assume that the Switch has... the similar concept to its or Switch's successor has a similar concept, which is that it is a multi-form device, at least in its basal state, that has detachable controls. Or I guess he did give us the out to just abort and say like, no, this is some other completely insane thing Nintendo's cooked up. There are technologies that would allow them to replace the control stick with something that has more durability. Because fundamentally, it's a mechanical component.
Yeah, Hall effect joysticks, like there's right. where they're less based on, you know, actual physical contact being made right. between components for the
it's magnetic fields
for the detection, and therefore, yeah, clearly, yeah, that is a lot of how the drift happens. Is that these things are wearing on each other, and over time they degrade. So, yeah, there are things, yeah, they could do, you know, with respect to components or you know, mechanisms that could make this a lesser problem. But of course, that's always going to be a calculation of like, okay, well, what, you know, it's all about margins with these things, isn't right. it? So, I mean, even if a seemingly kind of, obvious alternative is there, doesn't mean they'll go for it because we know Nintendo are very kind of strict about like having a healthy margin on these things on their hardware when they sort of put them together.
And before I get the email here, yes, it's technically electromechanical, not just purely mechanical. Okay, there, got it out. But they could also do something that's maybe cheaper, and they're not the manufacturer of these sticks. They have contracted with probably multiple companies at this point to provide them as a component. And if you've ever had to replace the sticks on a Joy-Con, which I've done a couple times, like it's a single component. There's the sensor and its computer board is encapsulated in a small metal box that the stick protrudes from. and there's a ribbon cable that comes off of it. And so like the entire component is effectively its own device that lives inside the Switch Joy-Con, kind of like an organelle. Like it is functionally not able to operate on its own, but it has all the components of a cell on its own, assuming that it was at one point such a thing. They could very easily do something like design additional robustness into the device. So rather than a single point of failure or 2 points of failure, make it 4 points of failure. That doesn't necessarily mean that the device is going to last twice as long. In fact, it almost certainly wouldn't, but it might decrease by, 50% or more the failure rate simply because there's an additional component that's also able to do the work. Or you find ways to produce that same sort of electromechanical interaction in a more robust way. It doesn't necessarily require additional components, but maybe build them more robustly or build them in a way that they're less likely to have interference. I want to say part of the time it's that there's buildup. So maybe you have something as banal as a sweeper built into the device that's cleaning the contact in front of the sensor. That would be really stupid, but there are devices that have these kinds of fail safes in them just designed to avoid things like dust has accumulated on the sensor cover. So I do think they're going to, assuming they are going to keep the same form factor, I definitely believe they would continue with the removable controllers. I also definitely believe if they're going to do that, they're going to take the opportunity of a console cycle change to do work on that format. They might still keep Switch Input, which is the API name of people who have built a non-Nintendo supported API to use Switch controllers on things like PCs and stuff. Because all those companies like 8BitDo are also using that to produce accessories for Nintendo. In some cases, like Hori, these are Nintendo licensed accessories, and Hori would very much like to be able to say, hey, this also works on whatever. And so from Nintendo's standpoint, keeping that standard around also probably makes it easier for them to do some backwards compatibility or to make ports of games or whatever. And having to write new control APIs is probably not something they want to do anyway, so be able to just reuse stuff. So even if it's a new controller, it might still be compatible just as a function of the fact it's speaking to the device in the same language. There might have to be some accounting for, hey, the sensory here is a little bit different. So if you read this input from an original controller, interpret it this way. If you read it from the other one, interpret it, slightly differently. Maybe the sensors on the stick are more or less sensitive in some way, so they would adjust slightly to handle it. But even with that electromechanical thing, that's going to be an issue regardless. Like, because my stick might be more sensitive than yours. That's going to get isolated. My Joy-Con's control input is going to potentially have more sensitivity than the one on your Joy-Con device. So there is already a little bit of that in play. And so maybe it's not an issue and maybe they could account for it or whatever. But I do also think they're going to want to use the reset of the console cycle to introduce a feature and to potentially feature cut in ways that make that device desirable to acquire. And just saying, hey, it doesn't fuck up as bad as the other one. That ain't it. You're going to need something a little bit more enticing for consumers than that. Because if you're not currently experiencing a Joy-Con issue, then why would you buy a new Joy-Con? I mean, obviously, you'll get a set with the system. But beyond that, hey, there was a period of, especially if you're not talking about the U.S. economy, there's been a period of rather sustained inflation, not so much in the U.S. And that's not been reflected in the prices of Joy-Cons, broadly speaking. And being able to reset on new device, so this isn't a Joy-Con, this is some other brand name we've put on this, that may have some other additional features that might factor into the name of the system and ultimately the name of the Mario Kart game. That was our transition. Remember, that's how we got on this highway. Would allow you to reflect the inflationary pressures that have been put on your device and the profit margin therein.
Yeah, although of course it's a weird dynamic that's going on for Nintendo specifically, because in Japan, inflation is much worse in a sense, because they don't have no interest in raising interest rates to the level that they've done in America, which has dramatically reduced the value of the yen. But then what that means is, of course, that all the revenue that they generate from the US, when converted back into yen in their, you know, their home, the NCL, you know, it's worth more. So in that sense, they've kind of been covered a little bit, but by, like, they are, without actually raising the price, the dollar price of, you know, some of the things, you have controllers, games, whatever it might be, you know, in the US market, they are actually still earning ultimately, when it goes into their Japanese, you know, books, more money off it. So they've had like a, Japan's very loose monetary policy has kind of acted as like a hedge for them in that regard. So yeah, that lessens some of the pressure to try and kind of chase the, you know, the price level continuing to go up. But there's no doubt after 7 years already, you know, we'd be coming up on pretty shortly, and however long it takes before the actual next system is actually ready, there will be because you've got to, when you're doing something like the start of a generation, it's not just about where do things stand now. There's got to be some sort of forecast about, you know, this is sort of the one and only kind of chance to sort of, you know, kind of set the level of pricing for some of these things. You'd hope. You do not want to be doing stuff like what they ended up doing with 3DS. Or indeed, you know, on the flip side of that, with, you know, they used to talk about Wii, like their sort of regret that they priced it too low, you know, like, because they couldn't keep it in stock and people were readily paying over the odds to get Wiis to, you know, resellers, scalpers, whatever you want to call them. So, you know, there will definitely be a sort of full accounting of like, okay, well, you know, how do we price these things in light of, you know, the very different inflationary kind of world that we've entered, certainly since the Switch first launched. But I mean, in terms of trying to read where they'll go on some of these things, I mean, it's worth mentioning, I think, that, you know, for instance, Switch Lite has been a somewhat surprisingly modest part of the hardware mix, ultimately. Yeah. Especially, I would say, in Japan, where it's sold, you know, millions of units of Switch Lite, but it still gets, you know, regularly lapped by, especially, you know, Switch OLED, but even like the non-OLED Switch with, you know, the old Switch with the, you know, that still has Joy-Con, unlike Switch Lite, sells about as much as Switch Lite. So it's in Japan every week. So it's just, considering, you know, Japan as the home of the primacy of a dedicated portable kind of game system, it surprised me the relatively modest scale of Switch Lite's penetration there. So, go on.
And you have to wonder how many of those Switch Lites ultimately cannibalize sales of what would have been the slightly more expensive regular Switch.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose there's all sorts of use cases or, you know, kind of scenarios you could consider of, like, you know, maybe the Switch Lites are useful because they kind of, you know, they entice people maybe to have more than one in the same household or something on a budget. Yeah, that's a little cheaper. I wouldn't say they regret launching it or that it doesn't have its uses, but the bottom line is that it has been dwarfed by, you know, the other models. You know, and so it seems pretty hard to walk away from that. The detachable controller sort of model seems to be if you're going to follow it up in a kind of relatively linear, you know, iterative way, rather than the, you know, the question about mentioning a radical redesign, it seems like that has to be part of the equation.
So one thing that about the email that I disagree with, this email in particular, is that the idea that the Joy-Con is the grand innovation. But really, it's pairing the Joy-Con with the dock, with the ability to live dock and undock the system. And that's not like a radical innovation. My laptop does that seven or eight times a day for my work laptop. But it's the elegance of it and how far, far, far better an experience it is than like docking my laptop where Windows freaks out for about a half a second. Then all my screens go nuts and then maybe my mouse doesn't work. I drop it in, bang, it's on the TV. It's great. But fundamentally, they control the hardware. They control the software. They've got a lot more play in it. So it's easier for them to figure that stuff out. If the Nintendo, we talked about this at the time. If the Switch Lite had a port at the bottom, it's a USB-C port, had the port, didn't come with the docking station, didn't have removable controllers, you can still connect other controllers to the Switch Lite. It doesn't care. It'll see them. Like it's a regular Switch as far as it knows. It's just those two Joy-Con are permanently bolted to it. Like they could have very easily put a dock port on that device for probably not much more money and then just let you buy the dock and been done with it. So I could see a successor system where the controllers are just bolted to the device. And that might also let them make the ergonomics of the device better. Because if you play the Switch in handheld mode without any kind of accessory, it's not particularly ergonomic because the Joy-Cons are serving dual purpose. They're serving that, like, you can take them out and play multiplayer with them. And that is part of the thing you would lose in this because you wouldn't have the two controllers that come in the box. That was one of their selling points. Ah, you get two player right out of the box. It's like, yeah, you do, but you get unequal experience because one of the controllers sucks and one of the controllers sucks more. But like, I don't know that that necessarily is a huge selling point. People,
maybe more at the beginning when the library wasn't as large and stuff like Snipper Clips was standing out more, and that you can get by in that game with the sideways Joy-Con.
Yeah, because that game was built for it.
Yeah. But the more that the library grew and the more that there were, you know, ports from PC and other consoles, the less that was viable. Like
it raises the question in terms of backwards compatibility, you know, because Switch was not backwards compatible with anything. That initial phase of these are the games that are available, this is what you can play on it, it put more of a spotlight on something like a Snipper Clips than, you know, if you have a system that has backwards compatibility with the immense Switch library that's built up over the past nearly 7 years. You may not get such a spot, you know, you just simply couldn't have that kind of replicate that kind of spotlight for that kind of game before. It's like, oh, well, this is available and it actually kind of, you know, is cognizant of these kind of new use cases that the Switch presents. That's one of the differences you could really see in, you know, a changeover to the next Switch. But that wouldn't be, you know, that's nothing new for platform transitions in general. I mean, we've seen with Sony and Microsoft, their platform generation transitions have become extremely soft. You know, and of course, some of that is the pandemic, you know, production knock-on effects, you know, even more kind of slowing things down because they simply couldn't, you know, manufacture that many of the new consoles to get into people's hands. But still, I think the general kind of trend was there anyway of just like, this is not such a thing anymore of like, we draw a hard line in the sand and move on and all that. But Nintendo, as we've said many times, has had a bit of a sketchy history of following up successful platforms. Yes. So, you know, whereas, you know, Sony for the most part has done it very well. Only PS3 was one that was difficult at the start. And even that, you know, you could end up selling 100 million. So it was by no means failure. No. The transition was difficult. But, you know, PlayStation 2, you know, PS4 building off the strong finish that PS3 had. And then, you know, PS5, admittedly, you know, the pandemic difficulties acknowledged. They've all been, you know, much smoother sailing than what Nintendo's generally been through after a success. Since like Super Nintendo, basically.
Well, and on the issue of like losing that ability to just immediately two player, Nintendo can also feel fairly confident that anybody who buys the Switch successor in the first year already owned a Switch, just statistically speaking, because it's going to be early adopters who are eager to get new hardware for a relatively limited number of games. So these are already like deeply dyed in the wool members of the Nintendo fan base, which means they almost certainly already own a Switch, which means they almost certainly already have at least one pair of Joy-Con, but probably more.
And I think look, the amount of Switches they've sold is extraordinary in many ways, yes. Right? It's done so well, but it's worth remembering some of the differences that have sort of prevailed now with Switch and going into the next generation from, you know, the kind of historical comparisons we can make, because of course it's a unified hardware line. You know, we don't have the days of Wii and DS or 3DS and Wii U anymore. Everything's kind of, collapsed down into one platform. And, you know, in those days, you know, they could sell, you know, over 100 million Wii's and over 100 million 150 million DS's or whatever it was, you know, at the same time. I do think, you know, with Switch, to some extent, because again, pandemic and its associated effects on, you know, the economy and production lines and all this sort of stuff, costs looms large in this. But, you know, I can imagine they, even though, yes, we've had Switch Lite, we've had OLED Switch and all that, they probably feel like there may have been more appetite from, you know, some of their kind of more enthusiastic consumers to buy more pieces of Nintendo hardware. Because in the past, they did this, you know, they had multiple hardware lines. They would have your DS, your DS Lite, your DSi, your DSi XL, and, you know, your GBA, your SP, your Micro. And obviously a lot of those were lower cost. So it was more, you know, kind of plausible that people would buy them multiple times. But I think, you know, they may look at it and think, yeah, you know, in this generation, as successful as it's been, circumstances kind of led to us, you know, keeping it pretty limited. And so they may think there is plenty of pent up demand almost from people, like you said, that already own a Switch, that are just, you know, they, but even if it's not like, oh, this next Switch that comes out, if there's nothing that obvious immediately other than exclusive software, which is always a huge part of it, really, you know, it has to be, but you know, leaving the software part out of it, as a device, it might not be immediately like, oh well, this changes everything, this gives me a new way to experience the games that I really want to do or anything, but that pent-up demand might be enough to get them off to a healthy start. But I guess the question would be, does it reach further than that if there isn't anything terribly distinguishing about it? That's the question, and that's really what's posed in the question, isn't it? You know, it's like, well, if you go radical and too kind of, you know, cutting yourself off from all the success and that you've built up, you know, do you risk a complete disaster? But on the other hand, you know, if you're, especially with Nintendo being in the business of selling hardware at a profit, you know, they want to sell this stuff to make money off it by itself, you know, then you need to make the hardware itself desirable in some way. And how do you do that if it's too, so there's too much continuity?
Right. And that's where I think putting another feature in or some other component to make that device, even if it's something like, hey, the ergonomics don't suck now, to make it more appealing.
Another thing I've always been surprised by, to be honest, given some of their past sort of practices, is that, yeah, they brought out a million bloody Joy-Con colors, you know, I mean, the various ones that were, you know, part of hardware, you know, bundles, you know, like the Splatoon 3 ones that came out a bit ago, or the Skyward, Tears of the Kingdom ones, but then also like just recently those pastel colored ones that they've put out, you know, like three new sets or all that. But they've never touched the design. It's never been like, oh, well, this is Joy-Con Pro. And, you know, it has, you can have one with a D-pad on it. Or you can have one that's maybe got slightly different ergonomics than the launch model. And they've never deviated, which, like I say, I guess it's different when you're talking about separate controllers. But even, you know, the Pro controller, they haven't touched that other than to put different graphics on it. There's been no second Pro controller that somehow has some other, you know, kind of feature or just, again, just tweak the ergonomics. Because, of course, you know, we went from Classic controller to Classic controller Pro and with Wii and so forth, and your Wii Remote to Motion Plus and the built-in Motion Plus, Wii Remote Plus or whatever they called it. Like, it feels like it's something you could rely on with Nintendo and their hardware, again, that they would make peripherals and they would make money off those peripherals. And of course they have, but it's been very modest. It's been very, let's just stick, you know, to something that doesn't actually go outside the lines that we drew on launch day. There's so many things like that. I mean, the eShop is like that, isn't it? You know what I mean? Like, the eShop is just something that was meant to work on day one, and that was it, really. You know what I mean? And it does not work with the vast, 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 vast quantity of games.
No, it literally doesn't. It can't load them.
That has come to be present on the Switch marketplace, and yet they won't change it. They won't. They just it's so, again, it reminds me of what I was saying about, you know, New Super Mario Brothers in 2006. You know, they kind of cobbled this stuff together for launch day, and then say, "Well, oh no, it's successful. Though we can't touch it. That's it. It's the Ten Commandments." You know what I mean? Like, I do feel like it's been such a long hardware generation. It's a little bit strange that they've ended up boxing themselves in to such kind of tight, kind of places with that. But yeah, at least it makes it even easier to draw a distinction when you do move on to the next generation of hardware, I guess.
So the answer is, I don't know, maybe. I think that's where we all landed. There's a compelling case for them doing something to advance the ball downfield, assuming we treat this as a successor. Or something that inherits the lineage of Switch, I guess is the best way of putting it. All right. Next email?
Yeah.
All right. I'll read this one. GX writes, "Dear RFN crew, Retro has failed to make Metroid Prime 4. In this hypothetical scenario, as a crew with incomparable vision and unwavering dedication to the entire series, Nintendo has come to you to finally blast this ball into the goal. What direction do you take with it? What studio do you use? How do you make a Metroid Prime 4 that truly lives up to its logo?"
Well, I mean, Nintendo knows what my vision is.
And, yes, maybe
like,
do.
I offered it for free, and they haven't picked up.
But who has the incomparable skill to maximize your vision?
Yeah, I feel like probably, I don't know, like, I have no idea. Like Unreal Engine probably has caught up to my vision at this point.
Since Sophia have wrapped up Fashion Dreamer, so maybe they can do Glitter Metroid now.
There we go.
Mm.
And also, it's a wrestling game.
Okay, all right, well, all right. I'm back in.
Right. But can you make Samus a rapper who also wrestles?
Well, I'd say,
can you defenestrate Snoop Dogg?
Yeah. it's a question we always have to ask ourselves, strictly for compliance with the FCC or whatever. The Trades Commission, whatever relevant regulatory body you're dealing with in your line of work. If you can make it live up to the logo, what about a 4-player squad shooter? No?
I'm sorry. I was still thinking about Sam is hitting our Hurricanrana on Ridley, but a 4-player squad shooter, you say?
Yes.
What do you got in mind?
That's all we know is the 4, so it must loom large in the design. So, like, that's the only logical conclusion that one can make.
All right, but what if?
Okay, so I actually needed to remind myself what the Metroid Prime 4 logo looked like.
It looked like the number 4.
Yeah,
numbers that we don't like.
Right. But now, I don't know, my brain is diseased. I guess I've seen too many Fantastic Four movies to just think of Fantastic Four.
No, it is very much the Fantastic Four Four.
Right.
It is. We were making that joke at the time. It's way too on the nose. But again, my disdain for quantity-based numbers and my acceptance of sequential-based numbers, I'm going to have to embrace that which I hate right now.
Okay.
With the idea that, Greg, your supposition is that, well, it must be a four-player squad-based shooter. What if this is more Mario 128? There are four Samuses.
Yeah, also, you know, kind of, but it could be done.
And it's Samus from different eras. They've been tricked. Because you tell them, like, time travel can't be in the Metroid franchise.
It could, or, you know, multiverse. The current zeitgeist is multiverse Samuses.
Yeah, right,
I don't know why you would need the multiverse Samuses when there's already multiple Samuses across multiple
Dark Samuses, XAXs.
Exactly. So we're up to three already, and you just need like one Samus, and like you're.
Jesus Christ. Those aren't actually Samus, though. There's not Samus in the suit.
Let's treat the concept with the reverence it deserves and refer to it as Samus Warren. Thank you.
Oh, for fuck's sake. God damn it. Yeah. I have to write that down.
Samus, Dark Samus, SAX, and Ben Reilly.
Oh, God. No, my thinking is these are actual, like, Samus in a suit, not like something that's taken on the approximate shape of the suit. So this is actual woman in suit who has interacted with the Chozo at different stages of her development. I guess you could do parallel universes if you want.
Yeah, one of them is like she's Metroid, you know, DNA mutation disease has like progressed faster than the others, so she's got, you know, the jellyfish bits sticking out of her body or whatever.
And so the game, rather than making you lose all your abilities and then recollect them over the course of the game, it makes you lose all your abilities and recollect them over a quarter of the game and then go into someone else and lose all your abilities again. You get to do this four times, which gives backtracking new meaning because you're not backtracking as the same Samus. You're backtracking as a very slightly different Samus with very slightly different abilities, which makes it...
Okay, but wait. So in this game that you're describing, in this scenario, can each Samus, only like one of them, pick up a different colored banana?
We're not going that far. We're going more like what was the name of the zapping system in Resident Evil 2, where if I pick up a gun, it's not there anymore when I come back through as Billy. Was it Billy? That was RE0. Zero had the zapping system. So I can leave items for Billy to come back and pick up later. That's the four Samuses here. If I pick up this Chozo relic, maybe this Samus can't interact with this Chozo relic. It doesn't work for her.
Samus can't open this door. You have to have the Samus that's the master of unlocking. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
What are the Samuses? Is the Samus from Other M that isn't authorized to use it?
That's right. And Adam's not in this multiverse, so she can't get in touch with him to get permission. But here's the thing. The problem right now is Nintendo's come to us and said, Retro has failed. We need a game. This is the third. But let's be realistic. If Retro has failed to the point Nintendo's come to us and said Retro has failed, they've probably already had an internal reboot once. So this is probably at least the fourth iteration of Metroid Prime 4.
It's the only sort of, you know, fitting at that point.
We need this
game. It is itself a tetralogy rather than just being the fourth game in the Prime series.
And what's the most important thing at this point? Getting this fucking development cycle over with. We need to get this fucking game out. Well, what better way than reuse, like, Metroid Prime and the Metroid series already reuses areas. What if we literally had a mechanic that had you play those same areas four times? You need one quarter less area in your game. Excuse me. You need 25% the amount of content in your game as you would need normally.
Well, now I'm thinking we need to hook up with Igarashi, because this sounds like his way of kind of handling Metroid-style
games.
You
got where I was going. Congratulations.
Yep,
we are gonna be efficient and get this fucking game out in a year.
Koji, stop making Bloodstained 2. We need you.
your time is now.
This is the first person spin-off. We still need your design sensibilities to get this over the line.
So my mind went different direction when you mentioned, James, that you've got like four, like it probably got restarted four times. I thought, well, maybe like instead of just trying to release Metroid Prime 4, you release Metroid Prime Superstars. You use those four kind of times that you restarted. You put them in one game. You say like it's a collection of eight great games because you gamed it a little bit by adding a few mini games here and there that don't amount to a full game. But yeah, exactly. And so yeah, so I think that Sakurai is the one who's going to be able to write this ship.
Metroid Prime 4 Anthology Edition, and it's just the four prototypes that have come out of this thing made playable.
Mm-hmm.
They don't tell any coherent story because they're four different games, but that's okay. Who do we bring in to make the fourth one, though? Just to get
that's a tough one. But I mean, the only thing I'll say about this in an earnest sense in terms of the design of the game is that I would caution against the notion of, kind of, okay, Metroid Prime's gone away for, over a decade. And if and when it comes back, how do you kind of, how do you sort of pitch it? Do you pitch it as this is essentially much the same kind of game as the ones that already existed and it's been away for so long that that's fine? Or do you feel the pressure of, oh, no, well, time's moved on. Tastes have moved on. The industry's moved on. We've got to have something that reflects, the realities, the expectations of players today. I would definitely caution against what we should do? Make it way bigger. That would be a mistake. I know that there are obviously a lot of games, kind of that have had like big layoffs, and have come back as these sort of bigger experiences have sort of had success with Nintendo, obviously like Breath of the Wild, for instance. And also I would put Pikmin 4 in that category as kind of, mm-hmm. Your Pikmin went away for, as it does, for like 10 years. And then it's like, okay, no, we're going to have a sort of a bit of a grander scale and all this kind of stuff. But I just don't think that would be very wise with Metroid. I've said many times, whether even in the first person games as well as the side scrolling games, for me what's really bewitching about those is the illusion of exploration and finding your own way more than the reality of it, because the reality of it is there's a kind of definite path that doubles back on itself and crisscrosses, and you can go off and find some extra things and whatnot, but really there's a journey that you're kind of meant to be going on that winds through this very carefully crafted kind of playground that suggests that there's this world out there to explore, but actually that is mostly an illusion. That if you say, oh, well, now we could do these huge environments that, you couldn't do on GameCube or Wii, and that's what it's going to be about, I think it loses too much of what I like about Metroid at that point. I mean, maybe it could still be a very enjoyable game on its own merit, but I think if you're looking for something to preserve, the essence of the series, in a meaningful sense, I think you risk losing that at that point. So yeah, don't go and get some developer that specializes in making, absolutely vast worlds that, are on a scale that Metroid's never had before, because I don't think it's compatible personally.
So we're going to give it to Monolith Soft is what you're
doing. Exactly. They're the last people that should go.
And they're going to turn it into a spinoff of, or as the sequel to, oh, wait, there she goes to Mira. That's it. She finds herself on Mira. That's perfect. Just nothing is going to go well for Samus anymore. Everything bad. What if, all right. So what if we could take the anthology series or figured out who's going to close it out? I figured out who's going to make the fourth prototype. So we have the four prototypes, and then you can have your mini games and shit in there. I think we need somebody who can take the literal concept of Samus is a bounty hunter, but bounty hunting is really more about investigating than anything. The final confrontation is what it is. She's normally doing detective work just in very precarious situations. So we need somebody who has experience like creating a game around being a detective and writing very original plots about being a detective. And what I'm saying is we need Swery to make his vision for it based on his very original Red Seeds Diary or whatever it's called in the West. I'm blanking on it now.
That sounds way too close to that Duchovny series.
I had it on the tip of my tongue a minute ago. Now it's gone. Damn it.
I thought that you were gonna, like, you were talking about, like, detective gameplay and stuff like that, and I was like, isn't that Sakamoto?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's why we have
No. See, Deadly
like,
King.
Are you pitching the girl who stands inside armor or something?
I am pitching to you a Metroid-style...
Deadly Premonition.
I'd actually go with Spy Fiction, because that's an even stupider game. But here's my reasoning. Because at the very end of his anthology, which would be the fourth one, so we'd play them sequentially. You'd zoom out, because Greg, you had the idea of, you know, this mapped area. It seems quite big, but you don't necessarily have an idea. We never actually get to see these in like 3D until Prime came along, so I want to lay into that. So the map spins around. If you had adjusted the map in just the right way, you might have noticed this all along. But as it zooms out and rotates, you know, it starts where Samus is and zooms out and rotates as she finishes up this prototype of a game. And the map rotates until it comes into the shape of a number 4. And you realize the entire world has been shaped like a number 4, which is literally the end of Deadly Premonition. It's shaped like the dog.
It's also the start of Doom 64.
There you go.
It's just the Doom logo.
it's a nice ending to this, I'm going to say at this point, 37-year development cycle of Metroid Prime 4.
That's you just need somebody who could just get something out, you know, get Tosei.
Right, just need
travel back in time and get 80s Tosei to just get it over the line, get it done.
And look, no man has more experience releasing prototypes of a game than Hidetaka Sudehiro, who released Deadly Premonition in a completely unfinished state, released a port of it that's somehow more unfinished, released Deadly Premonition 2, which is definitely unfinished, released Spy Fiction, which is not a complete game, and released Dark Dreams, D4 Dark Dreams Don't Die, the spiritual successor, and only got the first chapter out. This man knows how to release one quarter of a game. Get him on the case. Also, I just want to see... Oh, and The Good Life. The Good Life came out as a prototype. It will never be finished. This is what he does. I want to see this man's vision for Sam. I want to see what Samus's internal monologue, that's actually her real persona, talks about when they talk about film. I need that in my life. I need just Samus having a running conversation with herself full of non sequiturs. It'll be perfect. Again, very original man. Completely original ideas all the way up and down. I do like, though, that the idea of that Sakamoto make another fucking adventure game with Samus. Yeah. Just call Metroid Prime 4, but it's just the engine they used for a Famicom Detective Club.
It's got Hit written all over.
That's right.
The girl with the gun for an arm, or
that's right. Yes. There you go.
Sure.
It does have Hit written all over it, but there's another letter in front of it. So,
oh, damn it.
All right. Well, now that we've saved that franchise, and we've saved Mario Kart, and we've saved the Switch, let's move on to our final email of the day. Guillaume, would you please read it?
Sure. AG writes, "Hello all. With the recent announcement of the Steam Deck OLED... so close to the initial launch of the Steam Deck, is there any chance we see this affect Nintendo's next platform? Assuming they keep the handheld hybrid factor, would Nintendo just release an LCD screen at the beginning and hold off on OLED support? The sector Nintendo hardware resides in now has competition to the Switch compared to 2017. Are Nintendo even aware of the competition? They were with the DS. And question for Guillaume, as the last question was a bit biz dev, and he probably got bored. You mentioned recently you play games in English over French, and I was wondering why. Is there any distinction in the quality or meaningfulness between the tongues? Yours, AJ. AG. Well, I guess I could start with that one.
And, yeah, go for it.
It's a little bit complicated. There's a lot of factors in it, but you know, like probably like the main thing is that for the longest time in my life, most games were not available in French on gaming consoles. They were on PC sometimes, but not on gaming consoles because of various factors, I guess, like those translations that France got, that Europe got, we didn't get because the games were released here on the North American calendar, not the European calendar. You know, like there's no... The fact that a game existed in France in French didn't affect us most of the time because the games would be released here. Yeah, exactly. It would be released here earlier. One of the first times that I got a game in French here was Link's Awakening. I'm not sure what changed at that point, but Nintendo, I guess, released it. Must have released it at the same time in France and North America. I don't know. But it was definitely a translation from France because a lot of expressions just had me puzzled. Which brings us to the second kind of part of the answer to this question. You know, like French in Canada and French in France, fairly different, you know, different accents, but also different expressions, different, not philosophies, but like these days, there's a lot of English in France. You know, like it's very fashionable to adopt English words, and like they famously have even invented English words,
yes,
just because they love it so much. Like they talk about footing, which means like to take a walk. No one says that in English, but the French do. So
yeah,
there you go.
I can tell you from firsthand, Japanese have done this shit too. It's like, yeah, no, that's,
well, they've done this shit with the French as well. Like,
It's what have you done to my language?
Yeah. So that's part of it here in Quebec, you know, like being kind of a minority in North America, like there's been more like of a protective, like protect our language, protect our culture movement. And so like the Anglicisms, as they're called, are much more frowned upon, which has sometimes led to completely bonkers kind of neologisms that didn't catch on at all. Like they tried to translate hamburger into en bourgeois, and no one ever says that, right? But that's kind of like, there's always an effort to actually translate new English words into new French words here. But anyway, all this to say, like the expressions in France, like they're not, like we'll only encounter them when we're watching a show that's been dubbed in France or sometimes translated in France, but dubbed here. So like the accent will be right, but what they're saying won't sound right at all. And so the example I have is, I grew up watching Beverly Hills Cop, like, you know, movies like that in French, like dubbed. And I just remember Beverly Hills Cop 2, which is called Le Flic de Beverly Hills in French. And it's like already like the title flic is not like what we would call a cop here. So it's already a bad start. But then like at some point, what's his name? Billy Rosewood, like Judge Reinhold. I don't know what he says in English because I've never seen the movie in English. But in French, he says something, I piss in your butt crack, like, you know, like soft gonads or something, like sad sack. I don't know, like something that I have never seen, heard anywhere else than in that movie. And so it's really funny, but also like you can tell immediately, like, wow, this is not from here. No one talks like that. And I'm not even sure that's the joke in English in the original, because I think like he probably says something much more kind of common. But like in, I just looked it up, and in France, apparently, like, it's an expression that's been around like for 100 years.
What the fuck are the French into?
I it's just a way of you know, telling someone to screw themselves. It just means yeah, like you just like you look down on someone, like you they inspire nothing but disgust to you. Piss in your butt crack. I don't know. It's really weird, but like. So that kind of stuff, you know, like there's, it just doesn't feel natural, doesn't sound right. And we're kind of mostly used to it here in Quebec because we are exposed to a lot of France, dubs and stuff like that. But it's not, like as soon as I could get away from that by experiencing stuff in the original English, like I would. Of course, a lot of the games I grew up with were not originally in English. They were originally in Japanese, but it's kind of the same thing. Like I will find that the English translations sound better to me than what the French versions sound like. And it's weird because even like games developed by Ubisoft Montreal, I think that they probably write with the France market in mind. Because I've played a few Ghost Recon or whatever. Like I've heard the dialogue in those games, and they don't sound like they've been written in Montreal.
Is it? I mean, it's probably just a numbers thing, I would guess, unless you're going to produce two dubs. Because what's about 60 million French speakers in France versus what we say about 8 million?
Yeah,
Canadian French speakers.
Yeah, I don't know. Like that's. It's hard to say, like, so I don't want to get too into the weeds with this okay. question, but like there's, I feel like there's a way, like people here can definitely speak in a more universal French, you know, and in France also, like not everyone is going to say that they piss in your butt crack, like they can't adopt expressions.
I like to imagine that everyone says that when you meet them.
So, but there's a way to write characters that will sound right to most of the world, I would assume. But in a lot of games, especially like made today, that have, especially like I'm thinking of Ubisoft stuff right now, like you're always going to be, they always try to sound like tough guys, right? Or you're always playing a badass with a gun. I think that it's a little bit tougher maybe to write those without trying to make them colorful. And if you're going to make them, like, give them colorful language, there's not really a universal way to do that, except maybe, yeah, like, maybe lean more towards Europe. Like, because, yeah, they are more numerous. They're probably the bigger market. Well, they are the bigger market. So, yeah, that's probably the way that you're going to lean.
And it's more likely a Canadian French speaker would be at least familiar with it than the other way around.
Yeah, I don't know if they have someone like taking a pass, you know, doing a second pass on the dialogue in France or something, and then kind of sending it back with notes. I have no idea, but I would kind of assume so. And there's a third part of this answer, but that's a little bit more about the fact that I'm living with an English speaker, and she doesn't really want to deal with French video games most of the time. So that's also part of it. Yeah, like if I switch, the best way to play all those games in French would be to change the system language to French, and that takes a while, and that turns all the games into, like, that will switch the language to all the games to French. And maybe that's more trouble than it's worth. But
so you didn't want to hear what the flowers in Mario Wonder sound like in French?
I think that maybe did they translate them? Now I need to look it up.
I mean, they talk, so it's not like Mario where he just makes noises.
Yeah, but I kind of wonder if they just like speak. No, wait, no, I did read that.
I thought they did.
they do like they've got like Dutch and stuff like that. Like they speak in other languages. Actually, that was like one tip that I heard from a podcast that I listened to. Like, if you don't want to listen to the flowers, just change it to a language you don't understand, and then it sounds like they're not saying anything. And so, you know, so you can just tune them out, basically. Like, oh, yeah, it's just gibberish. But you can still read what they're saying. And so, like, in English. So you're fine.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Put my flowers in a Georgian language and we'll call it a day.
Yeah. But, yeah, like, so it's that's basically it. But from what I've seen, and that's one thing that I appreciate, like, the games, Nintendo's games, they do localize in-house, or, you know, they do make an effort to localize them for the Canadian market when they release them in Canada. And so, you know, like, there's a reference to poutine in Super Mario Galaxy 2, I believe. It doesn't make any sense, but I do appreciate the gesture of, like, we're going to acknowledge that, you know, where this game is coming out.
An effort was made.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because I do recall that there's at least one game that I know the French dub in North America and the French dub in Europe are not the same, not even from the same starting point. They were essentially retranslated. I can't remember what game. You know, it might have been the Leighton games. But then again, the Leighton games had different English dubs too. So, like, whatever.
Right.
It's complete nonsense. And that was completely unnecessary except to spare Europeans from North American Luke.
Right.
Right. So, no effort was spared, even when it probably should have been. So, all right, so we've kind of addressed a lot of the content of this question, the other part of the question already.
Hmm.
Sort of inadvertently, as we talked through the Switch or the Switch successor for the Joy-Con question. So I kind of get to the heart of the issue. There is just to give the context for those who haven't been following it, there is a rumor, and it is based on what are apparently Switch successor dev kits, and we've heard all kinds of stuff. So treat this with all the respect it deserves, which is to say not a lot. We could play a siren here if we had one. That the development kits for the Switch successor system are using LCD screens instead of OLEDs, implying, perhaps even stating explicitly, that the successor system itself will launch with LCDs instead of OLEDs. And so that's where the origin of this question comes from, because I cut it down quite a bit. There was a section where he spoke about, you know, the Steam Deck version 1 with the LCD to him felt like the DS, whereas the OLED feels like the DS Lite, like almost like a prototype to get it out the door, which is why he pulls the DS back in, because the DS was a response to pressure from Sony's impending PSP launch. So the question is this thing going to launch with an LCD? And I have a thought, but I kind of want to hear what y'all are thinking. It's a relevant question.
It seems plausible on the basis of, again, some point we've already made in the previous email on this general topic, that they will always look to have the hardware be something that they can make money on.
Making numbers at launch.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, okay, it's got to be something we can have. And of course, the sorts of realities of, you know, production lines and all that kind of stuff have been more sort of variable and unpredictable of late, you know, than previous, like, kind of launch windows. Exactly, you know, what the situation will be, you know, when they launch this device, we just don't know. And I guess you've got to price in some of this kind of uncertainty. But given that, you know, that is pretty much a pillar of their approach, is like, this thing has got to be something we can make in numbers, and that it all adds up to making some sort of profit per unit. It wouldn't shock me if, you know, when you put all the components together and you're trying to make that work, it's easier, or it just makes more sense to say, you know, leave the OLED out of that mix, you know, if that's what it takes to kind of make the whole package meet all the criteria that it needs to meet in terms of the costs and, you know, the production and the pace and all that kind of stuff. I could see them doing that. They're not the kind of company that's just like, oh, no. Well, we simply can't go backwards on display technology in any sense, you know, and therefore, you know, out of sort of pride for the brand, we can't do this. Like, no, they care about the bottom line. That's who they are. You know, so I could certainly envision a situation where they say, no, no, we're gonna, you know, for now, it won't launch as an OLED thing because that's what makes the package add up to the right sum. But that doesn't mean that is going to happen. It's just like, yes, it's conceivable within the way they do business that they would do this. But I have no knowledge, of course, of, you know, whether that, you know, with the particular kind of components that we might be looking at based on, you know, what people think the specs could be with these dev kit kind of, you know, rumors out there or whatever. I have no insight into how, you know, whether that you would need to cut back on the display costs to make these things add up at a price that they, you know, could launch at. I've no idea whatsoever, but it is the kind of thing that they certainly falls within their kind of range of, you know, kind of way you do business.
And dev kits do launch, or initial dev kits often do come out as projections. Like, they're not final hardware. And it's like, we just don't know. Like, I wouldn't be surprised at all if when Nintendo first started sending out dev kits for whatever the successor system is, they said, like, yeah, we're still trying to negotiate who our screen provider is going to be. So that might drive what our screen ends up being. Now, if you're going after OLEDs, you're competing with a lot of very powerful people, i.e. Samsung and Apple, who want to have a lot of those available for their phone products. So, you know, there's going to be a push-pull of like, hey, how many assembly lines are available? How many companies can produce this thing that we want to use? Or, you know, LCDs are better now than they were 7 years ago, and Switch certainly wasn't top of the line at the time. So, like, maybe they feel like they have a supplier who can provide an LCD that's very, very good. Now, it's always going to have trouble, you know, being displayed outside, but so does the OLED, unless it's very super bright. So, it's, you know, the fact that this, assuming we take all of these stories at face value, which is precarious, it doesn't even necessarily imply that at the time Nintendo knew what their hardware was going to be. Like, it may have just been like, this is our best guess on putting together the dev kit so you can start on it. We'll give you more refined dev kits as we go so you can lock this thing down to our targets. And eventually lock this thing down to final hardware.
And again, you could imagine it's more subject to change than, you know, in previous scenario generations where you're chipping dev kits out and all that, because it has been a more volatile time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if it isn't, you know, the one thing with the pandemic, you know, kind of affecting production lines. It's another thing where we get, you know, wars triggering inflationary spirals, and they're different, as we already mentioned. Mm-hmm. They play out differently in Japan than they play out elsewhere in the world, and then that creates these currency-based sort of situation, you know, dynamics and all that. I mean, there's more to think about. And as we always say, Nintendo, I think it's fair to say, as a general matter, quite a risk averse company. So, you know, they're probably going to look at a lot of that volatility and, you know, give significant weight to the downside risk, you know, the scenarios that the volatility presents. And that will inform, you know, how they go about things. So lots of things subject to change and lots of things to consider that, you know, maybe in previous such transitions, you didn't necessarily have as part of the calculus. So yeah, it, like I said, definitely somewhat plausible, but we don't know anything about, you know, how likely it is, you know, to actually play out that way. It's worth mentioning as well, of course, talk about, you know, the Steam Deck, you know, going from launching without an OLED to then having one as a subsequent model, a bit like Switch, although on a more compressed timeline. But of course, Vita did this in reverse.
Yes.
They launched with an OLED and then had a latter model, the 2000 series or whatever, you know, the model number, that then had a conventional LCD, right? So in that case, it was more like, no, well, this is, again, you've got to look at the approach of the company, right? Sony, that when they launch with, you know, a generation with a piece of hardware, that tends to be the Cadillac That's the one that had everything, right? PS3, right? It's got the PS2 in it, essentially, for backwards compatibility.
And the PS1.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I mean, you could just put a PS1 disc in a launch day PS3.
And I have.
And it would work and all that kind of stuff. And then later, they scale it back, you know, because it's like, okay, well, the early adopters, they're willing to pay a lot of money, and we're willing to sell it at a loss a lot of the time, you know, to get the ball rolling and all. So it's just a different approach, but it shows you that it's not the only way that these things go in terms of when you start, you know, with LCD and then go to OLED. You know, in that case, like I said, they started with the premium one, and then obviously Vita, you know, was never a huge success. I mean, had a certain amount of, a foothold in Japan, building off the greater mindshare that PSP had there. But, you know, I assume, you know, the latter model was mainly like, look, can we produce this more cheaply? And then, you know, maybe find a way for this to keep going. And it did for a bit, and then they just seemed like they lost interest more than anything. I mean, it wasn't that it was entirely unsuccessful, but it just didn't seem like they were willing to kind of put the, you know, the graft in, if you like, you know, dedicate the resources of the, you know, first party developers and the marketing and all that. It's just like, oh, it's, you know, it's kind of, it's small potatoes, and they kind of walked away from it. But point is that, yes, you know, these sorts of details, the components, the, display, but other things as well. Everything is a product of that particular window in time of like, okay, this is what makes sense for it. First of all, what's your overall philosophy? Which, like I said, Sony is very different from Nintendo's, and then, you know, Valve's as well. They've got their own approach. And then furthermore, you know, what's the precise circumstances at the moment? How much more does this cost? Do we want to sell this at a higher price? Or do we think, you know, we need to, as the first model in a new line, we can't go too high, you know, for it's all these sorts of decisions. As we said, they have in the past regretted, not charging more for things. So in a way you could say, well, if you think the market will bear it, hey, put the more expensive components in, still price it at a profit. And, you know, let's do it that way. But there's risk with that, because if it's not as desirable as you think it is, then you could be looking at a 3DS type of situation where, of course, you have a somewhat similar scenario in terms of you end up, you know, with models that strip the stereoscopic display out, be able to sell it at a lower price. I think, you know, at this stage, like you said, you can't put too much stock in things that are out there necessarily, because it could be fundamentally kind of legitimate information in the sense that it's not just something that's been conjured by people out of nothing. It's based on something somewhere, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it ends up comporting with the what comes onto the market whenever that actually happens.
You know, you were talking about Nintendo's risk aversion and trying to calculate all the things that you might want to consider when you're picking your vendor. It occurred to me, and I went and just confirmed it, and I am correct on this, that a lot of the manufacturers of OLEDs are Taiwanese companies who have supply lines that stretch into China. There is a very significant concern vis-a-vis that relationship right now that might make OLED availability an issue should something happen, which is to say the sort of impending threat of a Chinese decision to end the semi-independence of the Taiwanese state. And that would disrupt the flow out of China, and also the companies that are manufacturing them both in China and in Taiwan. LCDs have more availability outside of those markets. Of course, the biggest OLED producers are in South Korea, LG, Samsung, there's another one I'm blanking on right now, and they produce a lot of them there, but a lot of the ones for LG and Samsung are being produced for the use of LG and Samsung. They do sell them externally as well. Like, I believe Samsung provided screens for Apple's iPhones for a while, but you're competing in a market that might get narrowed by geopolitical forces beyond your control. That at times feel very real and very pressing. Hence the reason there are, I mean, not to get too deep into it, there is a current effort to absolutely flood Taiwan with Western-made weapons to avoid a repeat of the Ukraine scenario, to make it so unappealing that it's like, well, don't go anywhere near that. And this is part of the reason why, because it would be so disruptive to the economic flow of the East, or of, I believe they refer to that as the Western Pacific, in from a Western perspective, but from the East Asia region, largely. Whereas LCDs, or maybe it's more like LCDs are more cross-compatible. If I buy an LCD from this vendor, an LCD from this vendor, you'll get a similar experience. I don't know. I don't deal with the sourcing of literally tens of millions of needing to be identical screens. It's kind of an edge use case for people. You know, there's a thousand factors that go into making all these little hardware decisions. And if you screw up any of them, you end up with a Joy-Con that has bad drift issues because your vendor who designed the stick didn't take into effect the wear and tear of the stick. It's like, but it could be so much worse. It could be suddenly sticks aren't available. Then what do you do? Can you source an alternate vendor? So whatever the reasoning is, wherever they end up, there will be assuming, as we've said at the start of this email, that the Switch successor is such a device that the question of screen type is even relevant, which you would presume it will be, but again, we don't know that for sure. I am very confident there will be an OLED model of it at some point in its life cycle.
Yeah.
Whether it is, as you mentioned, with the Vita, which means life, early in its life cycle, and fades away, which is not a very Nintendo thing, or later in its life cycle, which in the Vita's case would be month 3, I guess.
No, I mean, it's certainly, you know, the idea of, you know, Nintendo screens getting worse as the generations go on is not something we're used to, isn't it? They usually get vastly better. I mean, you think of things like, you know, the GBA, where from, you know, the launch day GBA models to like the SP, the very bright backlit SPs they were putting out, you know, basically when DS was already with us. Like, which they were, I think those backlit SPs were like better than the DS screens.
The DS screens were a downgrade.
DS screens, for instance. But yeah, generally speaking, they get a lot better as it goes, don't they? That's what we're used to. But just the Vita example just kind of shows you that it's not the only direction that these things can go.
But I could see a situation where they do something like the Switch Lite. And part of it is they cut corners on the screen to get the price down.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's, you know, at some point it may be, okay, we've got our foothold like they did with Switch, where, you know, we've launched it, it's a success, but now we want to reach some people that, you know, we think are gettable, but we just need to be able to do it at a somewhat lower price. In the past, Pokemon has featured largely into this, right? 2DS. Pokemon had a lot to do with that. I imagine it played into the Switch Lite, you know, kind of creation as well. The franchise of just like, yeah, you know, this is a franchise where we want to sell multiple copies of the game into the same household. So we may want to have multiple systems into the same household, or, you know, just people getting their first system, that are not used to paying, you know, the really premium numbers for gaming hardware. So we want a lower price SKU to achieve that. And yeah, in the past, it's been, you know, like taking 3D out, or, you know, taking the Joy-Con away with the Switch Lite. But yeah, next time it could be the screen, yeah, just, you know, going from OLED back to an LCD. It could be something like that. So yeah, I agree with you. It'd be a surprise if, especially if it's fortunate enough to have the length of cycle, anything like what the Switch has had. You would think we're going to see something at some point that has OLED technology. I mean, with respect specifically to the Steam Deck, you know, having it and how much does this sort of affect it? I feel like probably not that much.
No.
I do feel it's, as I've already said, you know, it's really just about how they, it's their math, basically. It's how they, what, it's all about, we've got to put something together that adds up on our end. For like the kind of margins and the kind of numbers, the scale of production that we're looking to hit. The other stuff, are they aware of it? I absolutely believe they are. I mean, this is the company that likes to tell us, or certainly did like to tell us, that they were in competition with everything. You know, they're in competition with reading books while drinking tea, as well as, you know, Valve and Sony and Microsoft.
And Valve's a business partner of theirs.
Yeah, like, so, I mean, it's just, I feel like, you know, they're definitely aware of it, but I don't think it's at a level where it's like, okay, oh, well, you know, there's just, they're not into the kind of, and I don't know, you know, maybe it's unfair to say this about some of these other companies now, or, you know, at various phases of their lives, but Nintendo have always been, well, always been, but certainly, you know, for a long time, have been less apt to get drawn into this idea of like, oh, well, if somebody's doing this, then we have to, you know, outdo them, or, you know, like this, you know, kind of dick measuring stuff. Like they kind of decisively broke away from that in the transition to Wii. It's like, no, we are not going to make a console that's going to have nearly or more polygon pushing your power than PS3. That's not how we're going to win. That's not how we're going to make money. It's not even about winning against Sony. It's about how do we make money for our investors.
It's about winning against your ledger.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. So, you know, I feel like it's not going to be a case of, well, you know, like between what we did with Switch OLED and how Valve's come in, like that's just set a standard we can't walk away from. Like, nah, if the numbers don't add up for it, then they'll be happy, but content to just say that this is what makes sense. We'll go with that. So I don't feel like it's, you know, going to be, you know, like I said, but setting a benchmark that they'd be loath to kind of, you know, fail to meet kind of thing. But are they aware of it? They would be very much derelict of their duty not to be aware of it. Absolutely.
That they've definitely got some in the office. Let's put it that way. And I'm sure they look at them. They experiment with them. They play game. They probably do things like play the game on Switch and then play the game on Steam Deck and compare and contrast the experience. Now, obviously, with the hardware differentials and stuff like that, the difference is there's going to be some fairly significant experiences. But just to know, just to understand the market research, understand how easy it is to get the thing up, understand how, like, be able to project how broadly something like the Steam Deck could take off. You know, how inviting is it to the average consumer? How inviting is it to consumers who are more casual? What is its market segment going to look like? Stuff like that. Like, yeah, this is part of your job. If you run a big company, you have to do research on what people in the same spaces you are doing, even if you're not in direct competition, because one day you might be. And so, yeah, Nintendo's aware, Nintendo's working on it. But to Greg's point, like, they're going to make decisions based on their internal metrics. And that's it. Like, that's what drives them. This is what we think's important to us and to achieving our objective, which is be in the black. All right. Well, that is going to do it for email. We were going to read one more, but I think we'll just pick it up later. So emails go to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Try to think, how many did we get through today? Let's see. We got through all of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We got through 5. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. So send your emails and, we will use them on the show potentially. Again, reminder, retroactive 7th guest on sale now. Go get it. Go play it. It's pretty short. I've seen 6 or 7 hours. So you can do this and then contribute. We need your comments relatively soon because we want to record it before the holidays so we can release it during the holidays. You can post your comments in the talkback thread at nintendoworldreport.com, or you can post them in the Discord. There is a channel set aside for them. If you cannot find it, just ask. Someone will point you in the right direction. So that is where you can get your comments in, or of course you can email them to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Greg, music.
Yeah, what are we doing this week? We had a request in from Zed Fallen, who said, Nintendo likes to ignore Golden Sun in the same way they do with other... with other franchises.
Play Golden Sun 3.
Perhaps
it deserves it.
Perhaps understandable, given it's not a super seller like Camelot Sports Games, but perhaps when it's finally acknowledged with its Switch Online, I suggest a Saturos battle theme from the original Golden Sun, but Zedfall also mentions that it has a version in Dark Dawn, the third game on DS, and feel free to choose which version. So on the Switch Online front, obviously we had the quite surprising thing about Jet Force Gemini suddenly appearing on the Japanese service quite so out of sequence, I guess, because they've kind of announced a big... Well, not that big, but a tranche of games, and then basically like that's what we've been getting for the year, and I guess like 1080 was like the one that we were waiting on, and then Jet Force Gemini just comes out of left field for the N64 part, but with the GBA we're kind of waiting, as is alluded to there, we're waiting for that all the ones that they've announced to finish filtering in. And Golden Sun is one of those, but I'm going to go with the Dark Dawn version, but also because I checked and I think we have used one song from the original Golden Sun before that was a Zed Fallen request, actually. And also I do like the idea of in the same episode where a certain Mr. Jinderman lamented the fact that we're always doing stuff by people like a certain Mr. Sakuraba that we do indeed finish the episode.
Mr. Eight guitars and a pipe organ or whatever.
We are gonna go with Mr. Sakuraba here to finish the episode. But I've not actually played Golden Sun. So I am interested to try that out when it gets here.
The first two are good. The third one is not.
And yet we're using the third, but it was composed for the first one, so.
Yeah. No,
I kind of felt like I had been had, because the first one, they say you're going to have to light those four lighthouses and it stops at two.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was, so I got half a game. I felt really, I had been, they pulled one over me, but
it was
probably. I didn't need more of that game, really.
No, that game's the right length. But yeah, this is a good song. I heard it in my head as soon as you started describing it, which tells you something. So cool. All right. Well, on that, it is time for us to go. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.